This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Facebook is worth millions today. So yeah, they
billions.
Well, yes, hundreds of millions,
all right.
Billions.
thousands of
exactly.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a woman whose latest Facebook lawsuit has failed once again, Janie Skull.
Not just me, but me and my oar rowing twin.
Oar rowing twins, who I feel like I know them so well because of watching The Social Network.
I've never seen it.
Well, you haven't?
I really wanted to see it. Well, actually, I didn't want to see it at all when it first came out because I thought it was a little, you know, just kind of egotistical. And then I realized that Mark Zuckerberg had nothing to do with it, and it wasn't him trying to, like, you know, promote himself. And then I found out that it was a really good movie. And now I want to see it, but it's out of
theaters. Oh, much the opposite. I mean, I don't think Zuckerberg would like the movie because the portrayal
He hasn't even seen it, or he didn't want to see it, and he was not happy with it.
Well, it's largely fictionalized. I mean,
Exactly.
I mean, a lot of the plot, for example, is that, you know, all this Social Network is because he wants to meet women and, you know, and he's like has had this girlfriend
forever since he started.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a problem.
Exactly.
But yes, but there are these twins that are in the movie that supposedly they believe gave Mark Zuckerberg the idea for Facebook, and and they've already gotten a big settlement. I mean, tens of millions of dollars, and then they went back for more. To which I got to say, come on, people. I mean, tens of millions of dollars. I mean, that's plenty, right?
I mean, if you know, he did steal Facebook. Facebook is worth millions today. So, yeah.
They billions.
Well, yes. Hundreds of millions.
All right.
Billions.
thousands of
exactly.
Millions.
But, so at the end of the day, yes, they should get some sort of compensation for that.
On.
But my argument is, you know, I don't know if, no one knows if he stole it or not. At the end of the day, if they can't prove it, they can't prove it. So.
Greedy. It's greedy people.
It's not greedy if you invented something and someone stole your idea.
Here's another example of me going soft and left here. I've been talking with a lot of lefty friends about, you know, the rich getting richer and these, I mean, people, you know, these billionaires that have so much wealth. What are they ever going to do with it? We should just, you know, tax the heck out of them. And there's a part of me that's starting to come around on this that says, you know, I mean, how are you literally going to spend these $1 billion over the course of your lifetime? You know,
that's
we do have budget holes. Maybe we could, you know, take some of that back. I know that's Marxist. We've got a lot to cover today. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to have Amber's Research Minute. Chris is going to say, what's up with that? Let's get started. Daniela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Is it true, as Kevin Carey contests, that Republicans in Washington are embracing the worst elements of the teachers' union's national education agenda?
I would argue that they're embracing the best elements of Republicans' national education agenda. Look, Kevin Carey wrote a piece in the New Republic, quoted very smart guy from the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Yes, it was me saying that, yes, indeed, you know, the local control wing of the Republican Party and the anti-accountability wing of the Democratic Party are converging. And what that means is that both of those groups want there to be a much smaller federal footprint in education. They want to back away from accountability from the federal level. And you know, my argument is that this isn't all bad, that we've learned from No Child Left Behind that there was an overreach, that the federal government actually isn't very good at making states and districts follow through on mandates around accountability and other things. And I think the Republicans have a very valid case in saying, hey, let's give it back to the states, particularly now that we have such aggressive reformers at the state level, many of them Republicans, willing to take the ball forward. What's wrong with that?
Well, I don't like the idea that, you know, they're teaming up and this is going to be kind of a joint force. I think they're still diametrically opposed on so many points, you know, including teacher pensions and everything that's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and all these other states. It's not as if these two sides are suddenly going to come together and make amends and act as a single force. I mean, the teachers unions are still very much tied to Democratic Party and Democratic candidates. And yes, they might be arguing the same point, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that's going to be a force to be reckoned with, and it's unified.
Look, but you know, reformers like Kevin, especially left of center reformers, are upset because the sort of centrist consensus that gave birth to No Child Left Behind has fallen apart, and that consensus was never very deep. You know, this was something that among elites on Capitol Hill and the Department of Ed and think tanks was not widely held by rank and file members of Congress of either party, and certainly not the public or the educators. So they should not be surprised. Republicans are acting like Republicans again, saying, "Hey, we don't want there to be much of a federal role in education."
Well, I mean, I wouldn't even say that necessarily negates the idea that there is still a consensus. I think largely in the reform movement, there actually is a lot of movement towards, yes, we need charter schools. Yes, we do need some sort of accountability.
No. That's right. But the consensus is not right. That's true. At this, if you're talking about state level policy, absolutely. But where there is not a consensus no longer is around what's the federal role in education.
True.
Okay, good. Topic number two.
In New York City, much ado has been made about districts and charters sharing the same school space. How should Gotham manage this issue?
I think they should manage it on a case-by-case basis until charter schools have the funding to have their own buildings and pay for their own facilities. Then, yes, they're probably going to have to share space, and it might not be every vacant space should get a charter school, but case-by-case, you know, that's the solution.
So, you know, what you have happening in New York City, of course, this is an extremely expensive real estate market, very pro-charter school administration under Bloomberg, and you've got some neighborhood schools where people feel like the neighborhood school is doing well, is maybe wants to grow. At least an example in a paper, an elementary school that wanted to grow into a K-8 and feel hemmed in because there's charter schools coming into their buildings. And I think this is a tough issue. I mean, I think it's easy as strong charter school supporters. We definitely think that by and large, charters get screwed when it comes to facilities. New York City is such the rare example of a place where they're actually getting, you know, to be a seat at the table. Still, you know, look, I think there's a real value in neighborhood schools, and you've got to be sensitive to the concerns of parents who are saying, look, we want our neighborhood school to be as strong as possible, and if it's doing well and growing and more parents want to come here, we feel that to some degree our neighborhood owns this neighborhood school.
I mean, I guess I just don't see it as that tough of an issue. You know, in many cases, the schools that these charter schools are going to move into are not these well-performing schools with these really involved parents. And in the cases where they are, yes, I think those schools should have the chance to grow. So again, it's not something that I think you can really say either way. It needs some common sense thrown into the mix. And maybe that's naive of me to say, but...
Well, they should target the charter schools for places that truly have vacancies.
Exactly. Okay. And schools that don't have any even interest in growing, that just have these empty rooms. They need to go to good use.
Okay, topic number three.
Race to the top. Good thing or bad thing?
So be more specific here, Daniela. Good thing or bad thing? Wow, what is this? Okay. So the news this week, let's try this, is that the budget deal actually included $700 million for the next round of Race to the Top. I think a lot of us are surprised that so much money made it in there. Mm-hmm. Very surprised, actually, that K-12 education did so well in the budget deal.
Yeah, didn't
Not
really
quite sure how they ended up cutting up $38 billion from the budget and, you know, didn't hit much on education except for the historic whaling program. So... But the question is this a good use of money to do another round of Race to the Top? What's your take, Janie?
Well, you may disagree with me, but I actually don't think it is. I think when we're trying to make really tough cuts, this was an add-on last year. So to make it kind of a stable part of this year's budget, it just doesn't really make sense to me. We haven't really seen that much. You know, we saw a lot of states change laws and we saw them make a lot of promises, but we haven't really seen the results of much of that. Until we see that, I don't really think this makes the cut.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. So, you know, there's still some questions about how the money is going to be spent. Some interest in turning this into a competition for districts, and I think that could be valuable to try to get the same kind of movement we saw at the state level. To see that movement for some big city school districts could be great. Other people wondering if they're just going to give some of this money out to the runner-up states from the competition last time. If so, New Jersey, congratulations. You got big money coming your way. And I guess, I don't know, maybe Brett Shunnell will come back as state superintendent.
Yeah, and the question there is even how many states would this cover, or I guess they did it by districts, because this is less money than it was in the first round. Yeah. You know, the states that won the first round saw these big pots of money go towards them. What would this cover? Two more states? Three more states?
Yeah. No, that's right. So that's why there's a big argument for doing it at the district level, I think.
Yeah.
And the reason why the district is, because again, I don't know that we're going to get more leverage out of the states. The states must have fatigue from going through this, and if they went through it and lost. But at the district level, I do think it could be another exciting way to juice what's happening in the local school reform front.
Yeah, especially in those states where, you know, the state itself didn't really have a good application, but there were those really strong standout districts that wanted to be involved.
All right, good. A lot of consensus on part of the gadfly today, Janie.
Really?
We'll have to, some. I don't know.
Maybe I'm just not pushing back hard enough.
Yeah, well, likewise. I mean, you know, look, but that's okay. Maybe it's just that this week the issues on the table lend themselves towards consensus. Okay, that's all the time we got for part of the gadfly. Now it's time for everybody's favorite segment, straight from New Orleans, Amber's Research Minute. So, Amber, you made it back from New Orleans in AERA. Rick, nowhere to be found.
Nowhere to be found. Still in the bar. Last I saw him, he was at Pato's. And believe me, when I left, he was still there.
I mean, is there a chance that he is still there today?
There's always, never say never, is what I say with the Rickster.
So how was it? Did you learn a lot?
You know, it took some doing to find some, you know, some reformy sessions. Lots about... race, lots about gender, lots about social justice at the ERA. So, you know, I don't know. I have this theory that sort of, you know, the cutting edge sessions are all, you know, Tuesday at 8 o'clock, which is, you know, like the last session of the last day, or
mm-hmm. which is crazy that it's Saturday even reached into Tuesday in the first place. Yeah. 5 days,
right? Or Saturday night at 8, you know, when everybody's not at AERA. So I think there could be a little bit better organization of the AER sessions in terms of balance mm-hmm. And in terms of scheduling.
Yes, you don't think that there would be an anti-reform agenda?
Never. No.
Absolutely not. Okay, good. Well, what you got for us this week? Something fresh from AERA?
Fresh, well, no, sorry. But fresh from NAEP. This is the 2009 NAEP High School Transcript Study. This has been conducted periodically over the last 20 years. Readers may know this study examines the types of courses that high school graduates take during high school, the credits that they earn, and their GPAs. So this time around, transcripts were collected from a sample of 610 public schools, 130 private schools. It's a nationally representative sample, which means it speaks for roughly 3 million 2009 high school grads. Some of the key findings: in 2009, graduates earned over 3 credits more than their 1990 counterparts, meaning they took about 420 additional hours of instruction during their high school careers. Oddly enough, the number of school days and length of day has remained unchanged during this time period. So researchers examine whether other factors like students earning credits in the summer, whether they take high school credit for in the middle school grades or online classes can explain the difference. It does a little, but what I thought was interesting is that lots of schools don't actually identify in their transcripts which courses are online courses, which we know has been a problem in online research. So it was sort of hard to parse. A few other quick findings: the percentage of students taking a rigorous curriculum as compared to below standard, standard, or mid-level increased from 5 to 13% in the last 20 years, though a quarter of students are still taking below standard curriculum in 2009. This was interesting too. Primary reason that graduates fail to reach the next highest level of curriculum is because they do not take enough science courses. In addition, the percentage of black students who completed a below standard curriculum has decreased from 60% to 21% over the last 20 years, but there's still a sizable gap in the number who take a rigorous curriculum. Finally, the lesser sex is still outperforming in STEM. Males had higher average NAEP math and science scores than females, completing the same level of curriculum. So lots of good nuggets in there. Yeah, it's long. You got to parse through it, but it's well written. It's written for a lay audience. I thought there was lots of interesting nuggets in there.
That one on African Americans is fascinating, and, mm-hmm. and I guess relates to getting rid of the lowest track in high school. Mm-hmm. This big effort to detrack, at least at that level. And again, I think even for those of us who believe that there still is a room for tracking, particularly at advanced levels, I think we'd all agree that it's good if we got rid of these remedial courses that weren't heading anywhere. That's probably a good development.
I agree with that. I mean, I think one other nugget I didn't fit in here because there wasn't enough time. They did actually look at students who took online math courses and kind of compared their NAEP 12th grade NAEP exams compared to those who didn't take it, and did find that those scores were lower if you took an online course. So I know there's a lot of interest in virtual learning, and there's just a couple little nuggets in here that sort of whet the appetite in terms of, okay, what does that mean and how can we delve into that more deeply?
Yeah, it's really interesting that they say high schools don't report whether or not their students are taking an online course or not.
Yeah, I think we found that in Ohio when we were trying to dig in and do some state-level data there. And, they're just kind of behind the times in terms of, I mean, you know, believe it or not, it takes years to come up with a new code.
Yeah.
Like, all these boards have to approve it. And so it actually should be simple, and it's not.
Now, the headline for this study that I've seen is saying that, you know, kids are taking more rigorous courses than before. But, again, is this good news or bad news? Because we have not moved the needle on 12th grade achievement.
Exactly. Right.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's this big paradox. Kids do seem to be taking more rigorous courses. They're not learning any more. Coursing is whether we're just watering down those courses. And so they've got rigorous sounding labels, but the reality.
Right. That's what I was going to say, because you don't have a panel that's coming in and looking at the, you know, exactly what these syllabi cover. I mean, there's, it's a course name, and you know, these folks have a rigorous sort of coding protocol of how courses get coded, but it really doesn't get at the rigor of the course, mm-hmm. you know. So.
All right. So what is the song that goes along with this?
So the song, since science is still the black sheep of curriculum, we have an upbeat little song about about the joys of learning science by They Might Be Giants. I think you might know this. It's, they do kids' music now.
I own this. Yes, I do.
So you can sing along. Why does the sun shine?
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Yo ho, it's hot. The sun is not a place where we could live, but here on Earth there'd be no life without the light it gives. We need its light, we need its heat, we need its energy. Without the sun, without a doubt, there'd be no you and me. The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. The sun is hot, the sun is so hot.
Yeah, Jamie, so did you know They Might Be Giants is
I had no idea they were children's doing music. Kids' music now.
Yeah, it's good. They were really good stuff there. There's plenty of good children's musicians out there.
But it's still kind of their same sound.
Absolutely.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Good stuff. All right, it's now time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
To clear my head, telephone rang and you wanna chat. Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes,
Chris, before we go any further, how'd you do in the March Madness pool this year?
Not too well.
No,
I don't think anyone did well this year. Even the winners.
Well, there was a winner. Our producer, Joe, did win it all at the Fordham office pool.
What, one of two people? No, I think you were the only person that had someone in the final four.
Yeah.
That had one team in the final four, one person.
How did the president's bracket end up doing? For a while there, he was doing quite well. Do we know if he...
Checkers bracket?
No. Not that president.
Oh, sorry.
Checker Obama did have a bracket that we had to fill it out for him.
Yes.
And you did that, Chris. What was your methodology there?
Yeah, I... Checker refused to fill the bracket out, so I made one for him, picking the schools based on their U.S. News and World Report rankings, and he actually didn't finish last, even though he picked Princeton to win the whole thing. Yes, Princeton versus Vanderbilt in the finals, but... you know, he finished third to last, which is pretty impressive.
Or it just tells you that there's a lot of people at Fordham that don't know anything about sports. Okay, what you got for us this week?
All right. Well, I was shocked this week when I learned that at Little Village Academy, the decision over what to eat for lunch is anything but an option. Barring a medical excuse, students at the elementary school are required to eat the food served in the cafeteria. In fact, even if a student were to bring a brown bagged lunch from home, the meal would be confiscated and replaced by the cafeteria's daily special. What's up with that? I mean, where is this school anyway? Moscow? Sadly, Little Village Academy is a public school on Chicago's west side that has been operating under this policy for 6 years now. Principal Elsa Carmona said her intention is to protect students from their own unhealthful food choices. Why, thank you, Principal Carmona, oh wise master of the food pyramid, for protecting parents from the unforeseen dangers of grocery shopping. But according to her, the policy restricting lunch options is a fairly common one, even though she could not name another school utilizing it, nor could I find one. Maybe she should write a book about the policy and go on the road promoting it to schools across the nation. She could tell them how her students are better off not learning about nutrition, but being prescribed it. She could tell them how her parents are better off paying $10 each week for lunches that many students just end up throwing away. She could also tell them how the picky eaters are better off having to go hungry each day for not liking the mass-produced cafeteria rations. She could call it the Carmonist Manifesto.
Really worked out off about this one.
So now, a couple things. First of all, the Moscow reference, I mean, you're a little dated now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's now like
Moscow
an uber expensive capitalist city. I'm not sure that works so
but
well.
You got the point, right?
Well,
you get the gist across.
Yeah. Exactly. You clearly understood what I was going for there.
I mean, I would have gone for maybe Havana, maybe would have been good. Or
it just doesn't pack the same punch.
Yeah.
But I completely disagree with you on this one.
Really?
We came out with a book a couple of years ago praising paternalism in education, the new paternalism, right? Where, you know, schools are very paternalistic when it comes to kids' behaviors and helping them learn different skills, shaking hands, looking in the eye, how to dress. I don't, you know, this is classic paternalism that says, I mean, the schools are in, you know, supposed to be there to take care of their charges during the school day. I don't think it's unreasonable for them to say, hey, we want to make sure that kids, when they're on, when we have some control over what they do, we're going to make sure that they eat well.
But isn't the point there that schools are kind of filling in holes that kids aren't already getting? And yeah, kids that don't come to school with a lunch will get, you know, the free or reduced price lunch. Kids that are actually coming to school with lunches, their parents are saying, you know, are providing them with a meal, saying this is what we think is best for you.
Yeah, and if it's Cheetos?
It's
$2.25 a day to pay for the school lunch in this school. One of the parents they interviewed in one of the articles I read about this said that they pack a sandwich, some goldfish, and a milk for much less than that every day.
Exactly.
So these parents are being forced to pay way more than they would be otherwise.
So this isn't even, they're just going on the free reduced price lunch meal plan, or is that the reduced price?
Well, no, that's for students who don't qualify for free and reduced
lunch. Yeah, they're still forcing kids that don't even qualify for that to pay for this lunch. That just, that's... doesn't seem right to me.
You know, I mean, I think if you go to a boarding school, you have to eat at the cafeteria.
If you went grocery shopping, though.
But you opt to do that. You choose to go to the boarding school.
And this is a school of choice, too, right? I mean, look, I'm just saying that I don't think this is such a crazy thing. I mean, look, we are regulating the kinds of vending machines we're going to have in schools. There's rightfully a greater emphasis on making sure that the school lunches themselves are healthier. I think that... I don't mind a school saying, look, maybe it shouldn't be across the board, but to say, hey, if you're going to bring junk for lunch, we're going to trash it because that's where junk belongs.
Well, I did find actually many more schools that do have that policy where they would throw junk away that they found.
See, that makes more sense to me. To strongly suggest a certain type of meal than to force it.
All right. Well, we have once again found consensus on a difficult issue in American education. I feel like we've been successful today. Very nicely done.
Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. Thanks for coming, Chris. Janie, thanks for filling in. Rick, if you're out there, call home. Let us know if you're okay. Otherwise, we're sending a team to Patty O's to pick
put
you up.
Put the can down.
Yeah, that's right. Just put the hurricane down and stop throwing those beads. Okay, that's all the time we got for next week. Until then.
I'm Janie Skull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.